We've gotten used to seeing multiple choices when we're holding on to something we really want to get rid of. Let's see, the trash can, the bottle bin, or the mingled recycle bin. Recycling has been around for several generations now. We're well-versed in the practices. But do we practice enough? The recycling rate for the United States is around 35%, which might sound good until you look up the list and see Germany at around 65%. Our guest this hour looks at the promise of recycling and the reality in a book called Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine. Beth Porter is the author of the book and our guest on The Exchange. She helps people understand and make better use of recycling programs. She's run climate and recycling campaigns involving businesses and individuals, teaching them about sustainability. Her website is bethrecycles.com, and this is her first book. Beth Porter, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Jeffrey.
Sure. You start the book a bit away from the human zone and point out that nature is pretty good at recycling, too.
Absolutely. Yeah. For me, you know, my whole life I've spent loving trees and being in the forest and then studying forest ecology. And I've always been really struck by how ecosystems find use in their waste and break it down to something that is useful for the ecosystem to continue on. And it just seems so efficient, so smart. And I had hoped that that would be a helpful metaphor for people to understand how ideally we would be using our waste and, you know, kind of this circular method in a way where we can use it again and again over time.
It is a good guide when you think about ecosystems and the fact that very little is wasted in those. But however, in our ecosystem, we do waste a lot of stuff. And I don't know, I guess I'm still mildly surprised to hear that not quite a third, actually it's slightly more than a third of all the waste we create actually ends up getting recycled and the rest does not.
Yeah, absolutely. So we had a big boom era, which the book discusses a bit more at length in the 90s, where our recycling just really shot up. We were seeing an increase of programs. People were really excited. Massive, you know, consumer education campaigns from kids to adults everywhere. And that was a really, you know, hot period for recycling. And then we kind of got stuck there. You know, we had a goal of surpassing 30% recycling rate. And now we've kind of plateaued. And while our consumption has continued to increase and we've stayed at that, you know, 34% of all of our consumption, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done for us to see bigger returns on our recycling system.
Beth, can I guess that the book was started before China clamped down on taking a lot of our recyclables?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, the book touches on what was happening with China. I actually wrote it last year. And the China situation has been culminating for a few years now. We knew this was coming. We knew China was trying to ramp up its own recycling infrastructure and didn't want to take our, you know, kind of crummy recycled materials anymore. The standards were increasing, and so we knew this was going to happen. But this is the year, 2018, when we've seen it in full effect and the disruption that it's causing in the industry right now.
From your view, have a lot more people learned about recycling through this incident, learned about it accidentally, really?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, the one concern that I have is there's a lot of, you know, we're seeing scores of headlines that are like, the death of recycling is here, and kind of these apocalyptic scenarios. And longtime industry veterans like Chaz Miller have noted that we've had a number of downturns since 1990 with recycling. That's what happens when we're talking about, you know, commodity markets that are fluctuating. There's been ups and downs, and it's sort of cyclical. And a lot of long-time companies have learned to anticipate this and plan for these downturn moments in the market. And so I do think the communication around what's happening could be a little more clear, which is why I'm, you know, really glad that the book is out, because I think it helps people understand all aspects of it. And yes, we have problems with recycling, but this is certainly not the death of recycling by any means.
Well, and in fact, I should point out that the word recycling doesn't really appear in your title. The title is Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine, and you quote Annie Leonard from The Story of Stuff, "We should recycle, but that's not enough."
Absolutely. Yeah, the reduce, reuse, recycle is a hierarchy, and I think that's something that we didn't communicate enough when we were popularizing that phrase in the 90s and even still today, that that's the order we should be doing, you know, using our waste in, looking for ways to reduce our waste, and of course, creative reuse, repairing items we already have, and then finally, responsibly recycling. That's generally the order that we should be, you know, trying to follow. But I think a lot of people jump ahead to the recycle aspect and use recycling as a way to, you know, make ourselves feel better for wasting more. And unfortunately, that can undo a lot of the positive benefits we get from recycling in some ways. So, yeah, emphasizing that reduce and reuse come first was a really important piece for me.
The reduce part, I'm sure, bedevils a lot of people. And I can just imagine some of them saying right now, but we need the stuff, and that is how it is packaged. You know, what can we do?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. 100%. I mean, obviously, you know, utilizing bulk systems when you can go shopping and use reusable jars and bags to buy in bulk, that is the best. But not everyone has access to those. So I think, you know, having a strong recycling program is essential because we're always going to be producing waste. We see a lot of emphasis on zero waste and low waste things, which is great, and doing that wherever we can. But we are always going to be using resources and needing to discard them at some point. So trying to buy materials that we know can be recycled, either reused, you know, or that we know can be recycled in our local program is really important. So when we're at the store making those choices, thinking, oh, what will I do that has the least impact on the environment, which can sometimes be a bit of a dizzying process for folks. Just think about how you're going to dispose of that item when it's done. You know, don't just think about, obviously, we're thinking about the durability, the quality, the cost. But then take a look and see, you know, if your curbside program doesn't take a certain kind of plastic, maybe try to see if there's another option if it's sold in a different kind of packaging.
So it's an interesting impulse, though. You have to go from, I've got to have that, to, but how will I get rid of it when I'm done with it?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, just folding that question into the decision-making process, which, you know, helps us think more about our waste. It thinks more about if I need something. You know, sometimes we just need that pause when we're consuming and making purchases, shopping. There's a bit of a high that comes from it.
Right.
And it's sometimes if we can put a pause in that place to help people, you know, reconnect with what they're doing and how they're going to have to deal with it later.
Okay, let's pause right here.
Where a lot of change can happen.
Break time on the exchange. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Beth Porter, who is a big supporter of recycling and more than that, getting to the point where we don't even need recycling because we've done the other two things first, which are reduce, reuse. Her book is called Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine, Sorting Out the Recycling System. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange as we figure out the things we can do to reduce the amount of stuff that we send to landfills. 800-838-3760 join the conversation by phone with your comments and thoughts about the subject matter and perhaps your stories about things you do to recycle. Also, you can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Beth, I did a double take on the story you include here of Ryan in San Juan Capistrano, California. He was 3 when he started recycling?
Yeah, absolutely. Ryan has a great and very inspiring story. He went to a local recycling center, which I highly recommend if you're able to do that. It can be really eye-opening to understand more about where our recyclables go and what happens to them. And he was really inspired at the age of 3 about how cool it was to take trash and turn it into new stuff. Which, when you think about it, is a really cool concept no matter how old you are. And he went on to start a program with his father and mother, obviously, because he wasn't able to drive yet, where they go and pick up recyclables and try and help people understand how to recycle better. And he's had kind of a whirlwind of success from being so inspirational and positive about recycling. People all over the world send in letters and ask him questions about how to do things better. So he's not just helping people understand, you know, what do I do with my pizza boxes? He's helping people get enthusiastic about this environmental action that we can all take, which is really wonderful.
How old is he now?
Now he's about 9.
Okay, so he's been doing this for a long time and sticking with it?
He's been doing this for a long time. Yeah. I mean, thousands and thousands of tons of waste that he's helped divert from his landfill. He's gotten an award from his local recycling center, you know, as a kind of a hero for the community on recycling. And he's continuing on and now is also directing a lot of his efforts into beach cleanups and trying to make sure that we're picking up some of that plastic waste we've been seeing that's plaguing our aquatic environments.
Well, one of the good things, among the good things about the book is the fact that you do give us some realms outside of just the stories of recycling now. We've already talked about the comparisons to ecosystems and how very little is wasted out in the forest, for example, or in the ocean for that matter. But there's also some good history in here, too. And you point out that recycling was patriotic once. When was that?
World War II era. We may not have called it recycling back then, but the scrap drives, the efforts to, you know, victory gardens and reduce waste, and particularly the scrap drives is what I found very interesting because there was so much community enthusiasm around, you know, collecting stuff that we no longer needed and taking it apart and sending it over for the war effort. That was, I think, the last time in our history that the entire country really rallied behind an action that was essentially, you know, sort of an environmental one in many ways, but it was for the war effort. So I found that really interesting to help folks understand and conceptualize how our relationship with waste and recycling has evolved over the decades.
Were people picking things up because they got money from it or because they just got a good feeling from it? I mean, what were the motivators for people to turn in their stuff?
Both, yeah. Sometimes there would be a small monetary incentive, but once the scrap drives became such a big thing across the entire country, you had some counties were competing with other counties or other states. So you had that spirit of competition at play as well, but it was all for the larger effort of, you know, supporting the troops. That's something that everyone could really get behind because so many people were personally affected by the war and wanted to do what they could to contribute and, you know, do something for their greater community.
So here's where we get to the point, though, where markets are involved. Did the government intervention create an artificial market, for example, for scrap metal in World War II?
The government certainly did create a call for that. Once they saw the scrap drives really taking off from Nebraska was the first state to do a statewide scrap drive, and they saw the enthusiasm, and the federal government called for, you know, set some standards, set some goals for national scrap drives and kind of tried to steer that enthusiasm to material recovery. But we really have over the years seen the federal government take a bit of a back seat from, you know, state and more local governments that run our recycling programs now. And in some ways that's been a challenge for recycling and has sort of resulted in where we are now with fragmented systems, different confusing rules. You know, you go from county to county and the recycling rules change, and people can find that a little frustrating. So we don't really have a big national coordinating entity that's steering our recycling program. It's all local governments.
Beth Porter's
and
our guest.
Markets.
Right, markets. Beth Porter's our guest. Her book is Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine, Sorting Out the Recycling System. So you point out that it is different from town to town, and one of the major points of the book is there's skepticism that recyclables are being used again. How great is that skepticism?
Yeah, I think these myths start because, you know, and I think they're understandable, honestly, because when you don't know what's going on behind something, when there's just a bunch of mystery and we think of this as a magic box that just happens, that can breed a lot of skepticism, confusion, and people just don't understand how it works. And so I wanted to explain that in the book and remove some of that mystique from our recycling programs. But a lot of cases, you'll talk to someone who saw someone who saw someone else, who heard from someone that they saw recycling and trash being thrown in the same truck one time. But we have no evidence that that is happening on a large scale nationally. And to an individual person who would see that happen, I would say, you know, call and report that truck to the company and you know, let someone know that that's going on. But as far as recycling goes, you know, it is getting into the recycling streams that we need. Now, the challenge is contamination. We've seen a huge rise in contamination the last few years. About 30% of what's going to our recycling facilities is stuff that should not be there. So in that case, that stuff does get rerouted to the landfill because there's not a way to collect, sort, and sell those items. So things like bowling balls, dirty diapers, garden hoses, old Christmas lights. These are all things that can't be recycled through our municipal programs. So those will be rerouted to a landfill or, you know, other disposal sites. So there are some things that we think might be recycled that are going to landfills, but it's typically because they shouldn't have been in the recycling stream in the first place.
You know, I know that people do like to talk about recycling and want to be able to do more of it, but you actually have filled up every phone line, and we have six. And there are three emails waiting as well. So let's start to take some of these. Let's start with Bill and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Beth Porter, the author of Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine.
I wondered if you consider the state what do you think of a state having a earth and medical friendly sales tax that would the money would lower real estate taxes and it could not be changed without a vote of the people of 75% of the majority, and it would not include heating your home. It would be a sales and there would be no sales tax on used items. Items with 60% made with 60 to 80% other materials. Mm-hmm. And as far as medical, it would not include any food you buy in a supermarket or grocery store that meets a WIC program, because Oregon's third biggest industry is tourism, and we don't make any money on all the junk food that's sold, and it's killing. And right now, 40% of the people in the United States are obese or diabetic. And as far as education, it wouldn't tax anything you read, pornography or the Bible. And I was wondering what you'd think of a sales tax like that.
All right, thanks for that, Bill. So sales tax to incentivize items that do have a lot of recyclable content in, or recycled already content. What do you think about that, Beth?
Yeah, you know, I can't speak to a sales tax that's quite that extensive. That's a lot of really interesting and compelling areas you just mentioned that I think is, you know, worth talking about further. But there are a lot of mechanisms to supporting recycled content that are out there that some communities have started practicing, some companies are practicing, and I think we could do much more of that. Recycling in general is not very well supported. There's not, you know, subsidies in the same way that, say, a waste-to-energy incineration facility. They get tax credits for the energy it generates, but there's not really a way to offer tax credits for the energy we save by recycling. And so, you know, ways to try and recognize these externalities from our recycling programs, all the environmental benefits, all the community benefits we get from recycling, it would be great to fold that in more to offer more support for building up our recycling infrastructure. But absolutely looking for market ways to incentivize recycling. Pay-as-you-throw programs has been very effective in many communities. That's where you pay to throw away your trash, but your recycling and sometimes composting services are free. And that's a way to drive incentive to have folks participate more in recycling programs if they're having to pay per bag of trash for their, you know, the waste they're throwing away. And so that's more of a, there are different kind of mechanisms that we could explore like that. And I definitely lay a few out in the book, but I think that's a really interesting scope to look at for a sales tax. Covering a lot of ground there with that suggestion, for sure.
Indeed. Another call here from John in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Beth Porter. Her book is Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine.
Hi, I'm John from Mendocino. I don't know where to start. I think this is a terribly futile subject matter. I've been trying my whole life and seeing it become more and more futile. Most recently, this idea that the Chinese have dropped us, probably because of that 30% you're talking about that can't go to recycling. But more importantly, I'm wondering if we don't need to start way farther down on the list. Like, for instance, people's mentality is horrible on recycling and all that. And some of it goes to our upbringing. It goes to listening to the news and having capitalism as being a mantra that is unassailable. And capitalism really has no moral values, and capitalism says that waste is a good thing and that recycling can maybe even be a bad thing. And so we're up against all this stuff. And then I hear that the mafia is buying up municipal waste and trash by the barge load and taking the money and then dumping it out in the ocean. And so I wonder, this is going to get a big jump start with what's happened with China. That trash is going to go somewhere. Americans aren't going to deal with it. They're just too proud and too spoiled to deal with it. And then the other thing is, what about starting out making your trash more recyclable? We don't have. That's the reason all that stuff's going at 30%, because we don't even attempt to make it recyclable at the start. Mm-hmm. Where do we start on all this? I'll get off.
All right. Thanks, John. You're right. There's a lot of places to go. It's a lot of places to start. Beth, pick it up from there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we need a greater accountability for producers. So companies that are making this stuff need to be designing products for recyclability. They need to be using recycled content as much as possible, but then also making sure that their products are recyclable, and not just in one or two counties. You know, we need to focus on making sure that products are being made with recyclability in mind for the vast majority of the United States. And I think a big part of that, which I touch on in the book, is about communication. We've got all of these stakeholders in the recycling system. It's not even an industry. It's a system of all sorts of different groups that are overlapping with each other, but not always communicating with each other. So, for example, you've got producers of electronic waste. We're seeing a huge increase of electronics and planned obsolescence with, you know, items that are usable for 2 years and then they need to be thrown out. So not only are we needing to be like pushing right to repair policies for those kinds of items, but electronics recyclers need to be communicating more with producers. If producers came down and said, hey, we want to, you know, design this new product, how do we make it so that you guys will be able to recycle this efficiently and effectively and safely? Those kind of conversations need to be happening more and more. And I think the onus is really on producers to make sure they're making products with the end of life disposal in mind. And one way that individuals can try and hold that accountability is by calling companies out on social media, tagging them, really making sure that, you know, you're saying, why isn't this product recyclable? Why are you not using recyclable packaging? That kind of stuff really does make a difference. And we are seeing more and more enthusiasm for recycling. A recent survey that came out said that I think about 70% of folks think recycling is extremely important and that we need to be focusing on that. This is also a bipartisan issue. So there is still a lot of enthusiasm, although definitely a few naysayers about recycling. But I think we're seeing now with the ocean pollution issue, waste is at the forefront of people's minds. And we need to kind of harness that and really make sure that we're talking about waste responsibly and communicating clearly the steps that people and companies need to be taking to improving our recycling system.
That's a really interesting point, though, that it goes beyond just being able to vote with your pocketbook, because in the age of social media, you can have an impact in other places other than just at the checkout.
Oh yeah, absolutely. We can express demand, you know, by the purchasing choices we may make, of course, and then also expressing our thoughts on social media. The more public, the better. And then, you know, going to local town halls, city council meetings, and saying, "What's our plan for reducing waste? What's our plan? What's our recycling target? What are our goals as a community?" And making sure that the local government has a plan for that and is understands that the community values it and is taking it seriously.
We have another call here from, this will be Pam and Dexter. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Beth Porter, the author of Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine.
Hi, well, another great topic and so important as more and more humans are being brought into the planet and we're consuming more, polluting more. You kind of touched on a little bit of what I was going to say is I think 40% of our food gets thrown away. And so I urge people, first of all, to not waste food. And then source your food as locally and organically as possible, because then the more it travels, the more fossil fuels used. And so composting is a great way to, if you have organic, especially organic, then you have a little organic garden or maybe some potted herbs and vegetables, it's a great way to add nutrients to your soil and not throw that into the landfills, which I didn't know, but water and food leaches chemical toxins out of other products that are in the landfill. So that's one of the reasons why it's really bad to just throw your food into the trash. And then another thing that I've trying to raise awareness about is to reuse and buy used items. Go to thrift stores. Buy your clothes at thrift stores. One cotton T-shirt takes 70 gallons of water to produce the cotton to make a T-shirt. And conventionally grown cotton, I have it here, 25 pounds of cloth to make out of cotton uses 4.45 pounds of chemical pesticides, fertilizers, and insecticides. So, you know, we really need to do everything we can. We're in an environmental global crisis. You know, we got climate change. We got our waters are being contaminated. Our oceans are contaminated. And, you know, here we are entering into the shopping season. So I just hope people, instead of talking about recycling as much, is every time you buy an item, question, do I need this item? And do I even need to go shopping? Because you had mentioned earlier, you kind of get a high, an endorphin rush off of buying things and shopping. And so I just think that we all need to help each other out to encourage us to transition to more sustainable lifestyles. And shopping in and of itself is kind of a bad idea.
All right, Pam, thanks for the call.
I'll listen to the rest on the radio.
All right, take care.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, no, couldn't have said it better myself. That definitely touches on two issues that I discuss more in the book, which is, clothing waste. That is massive. And then food waste, of course, is a huge problem. And as you said, when we're peering into the holidays, we're looking into a huge increase in our consumption and waste as a country. I recently saw a survey, I can't remember what news outlet shared it, but 70% of the folks they surveyed wished that they did not have to purchase gifts. They don't want gifts, and they will only, but they would only forego doing the gift giving if everyone in their family agreed to it. So I think there is some sort of, need for us to simplify our holiday process in particular. People find it stressful, expensive. I read that one individual might spend $600 on gifts and all the demands of the holiday season. So making the first step and being the first one in your family or group of friends to say, hey, how about we go out to dinner? How about we, watch a movie or have a board game night and not focus so much on the gifts this year, just to try and get that ball rolling. And it might really resonate with other folks to try and simplify this hectic and very wasteful season we're looking into.
It might indeed. I can tell this topic has certainly resonated with our listeners because we filled up all the phone lines and got several emails as well. We'll come back and get more of those in. And when we resume talking to Beth Porter about Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine, back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. And boy, are we getting the phone lines burning up by talking about recycling on the exchange today, or the lack of it. We actually get to not quite 35% in actually recycling our solid waste in this country. Beth Porter points out this and many other facts and figures and histories in her book, Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine, Sorting Out the Recycling System. It's a conversation you're welcome to join at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I wanted to bring in an email here from Patricia Ann. I don't see what town she's in from, but it kind of follows up on the discussion about food waste. And she says, please address that plastics are not recycled. That is, new plastic does not come from recycled plastic. Downcycling is the only thing happening. Take your own wear and leftover containers. And she signs it, yours in least waste, Patricia Ann. Thank you for that, Patricia Ann. Thoughts on that, Beth?
Yeah, absolutely. Patricia's right. Plastics are our lowest recycling rate of any material that we recycle. It's about 8 to 9% globally, I believe, or maybe 10% globally and 9% in the United States. Either way, it's a tiny amount compared to the amount of plastic that we're generating. And plastics are really, they're a very versatile and very durable material, but that comes at a huge cost. That durability means that we're using it for these single-use products, and a lot of them aren't recyclable. Plastic straws, plastic utensils, and small cups and things like that aren't always recyclable. And so that's a huge issue that we need to be focusing on. And I'm really glad that plastics have received so much attention this year. And also the flexibility that plastics come with, because they can be made into so many different types of materials, that can cause a lot of confusion at the recycling facilities that are trying to sort out all the different types of plastics that melt at different points, that require different processing techniques. And so that's another situation and perfect example of producers need to be thinking about the end of life for their products and how to make them more recyclable. And coming up with new different resins of plastic, I think, is not the best way for us to get there.
Larry in Arcata also sent an email, and he wants to know, would more recycling happen if containers were clean and did not have glued-on labels? These changes could reduce the cost of recycling and make it more environmentally friendly. Again, that's from Larry in Arcata.
That is a great point, Larry. Contamination is a huge source of issues for recycling right now, and part of why China has stopped taking our recyclables, part of why we're seeing this disruption in the industry right now. And labels on items are not as huge of an issue. So if you have like tape or a label on a cardboard box, for example, that actually does not need to be removed for recycling. But if anything's coated in food or beverage, that can absolutely be a problem. So, you know, we always tell people clean, empty, and dry. Just try and make sure there's not food or beverage dripping from the container. You don't have to wash it perfectly clean, but thinking about the life it's going to have when it leaves your home and, you know, gets transported to a sorting facility and gets sorted. If there's a ton of food on there, it's very easy for that food to get onto other materials in your bin or in the truck and cause some big problems. So clean, empty, and dry is definitely one of the new phrases we're trying to spread about recycling, right?
There's a video that is available on YouTube, and I don't have access to it at this moment to be able to tell people where to find. I know it was put out there by Rogue Disposal based in Medford and the recycling company, the carting company based in Eugene as well. But it shows somebody who's thinking, well, I'm going to be virtuous and recycle. And they dump this dirty salad bowl made of plastic with all the dressing still on it into the recycle bin. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you hear people get frustrated sometimes. They're like, don't, you know, I'm trying to do the right thing. And I think the intentions are great. And it's important that, you know, I don't want to demonize people certainly for trying to recycle and you know, learning something new. Don't feel horribly ashamed of any mistakes about recycling you've made in the past. It's just, you know, what do we do going forward, you know, once we learn about the complexities in the system and how to recycle better. And sharing that with others is key in making sure, people learn this stuff because it's, you know, it's not necessarily intuitive. It's practices and it's little changes to our recycling habits that we need to make. And sometimes that can be as simple as, you know, if you have an empty bottle of a beverage, just giving it one little shake before you put it in the bin just to make sure there's not any leftover liquid in there. So just, you know, small little 1 degree shifts and changes in our behavior can go a long way.
1 degree, that's a good way to put it. Let's take another call here. Carter in Wolf Creek, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for waiting.
Yes, good morning. What I would like to hear from your guest is what she knows about designing materials that go into the product stream that are not toxic when they're recycled, or they don't even have to be recycled, or there's already a responsibility taken, you know, up front in the design of the product that it is in place a recycling circuit. And then the second question is, does she know of any university courses where what I'm talking about is actually taught to people and where they can go and find jobs doing this?
All right, good questions. Thanks for that, Carter. Appreciate it.
Yeah, great questions. Absolutely. And I think, you know, as we mentioned before, this is absolutely something that needs to be happening at the design stage. And when companies hear and know how important recycling and recyclability is to individuals, that really helps when someone like me from a nonprofit urges them to change their practices. So like I, you know, said before, the more you can talk about it on social media, the more you can contact that company or, you know, any company that you're buying from and demand this as a customer, that really is extremely valuable to shifting the practices of that company to include recyclability in their design phase. And more communication facilitated between producers and recyclers can really help producers incorporate recyclability into their design. And yeah, I thank you for bringing that up because we can't state enough how important that is to helping the system function. And in terms of classes, I know, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, there's a really cool program that I mentioned in the book, the Master Recyclers Program. And this isn't done through any university specifically, but it's a program that folks can take a couple weeks of courses of learning very in-depth about, you know, the discard studies aspect. And discard studies is actually another website that you can go to find out more on classes on this. Those are two great options to learn more in terms of, you know, more of an academic setting and learning things that we can take out into the world and put into place. And jobs, whew, absolutely. I mean, for every one job at a landfill, you can get up to 10 jobs in a recycling system. It's certainly a big source of jobs. We've got 500,000 folks in the United States working in different aspects of recycling already, which is phenomenal. And if we expand our reuse and repairing That's another potential for a lot more jobs and specific trades that people can use to help repair items. So building up that economy is certainly another very important area we need to focus on. So I hope that's helpful in terms of, I think that's a great question. You know, how are we teaching people these things and then making sure that they, you know, go on into this system to be able to have a job and, contribute to this this larger recycling system.
Now, the Master Recycler program in Oregon is run often out of the extension agencies. So contact the extension agency in your county, and they'll at least know where to direct you if they don't run it themselves in your particular county, we've discovered. Another phone call here. We're going to Jeff in Arcata. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Beth Porter.
Thank you. Hi, Beth. I was wondering if you could address the issue of online packaging. It seems to me there's excessive packaging there, and hopefully you can address that issue. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So, yeah, we moved from the emphasis that we've been having on the responsibility for the producer to reduce, but now you got people ordering things at home, and all of a sudden they're getting levels of cardboard and plastic that they wouldn't have gotten if they bought at a local store.
Yeah, that's a great question. And we are seeing a shift in the source of recycled cardboard. It used to be more commercial. Stores would be recycling a lot of the cardboard, but now we're seeing a shift into the residential. We've got people with their Amazon orders and all sorts of online orders with more cardboard boxes. So the number one thing I will say is please break down your cardboard boxes in the recycling bin. Sometimes when we have larger recycling bins, it can be easy to just, you know, throw it in there. But breaking it down is really helpful in terms of the transport and then further sorting process for recycling. So that's one big tip across the board for cardboard there. But yeah, we're seeing a lot of attention about the packaging. And specifically, I just want to say Amazon, because, I mean, you know, we can't be shy about the fact that they are a large, massive online shopping retailer and are known for packaging small items with sometimes a ridiculous amount of plastic packaging on the inside and cardboard on the outside. So Amazon's been receiving a lot of attention for this and a lot of encouragement and urging from nonprofits and customers alike to improve its packaging. And so it's taken a couple steps, and I think it can still take more. They offer now, you know, an eco-efficient way that you can have your items sent to you. I think they're trying to reuse packaging a bit more. And then the company recently donated, I think, $10 million to improving recycling infrastructure in the country. So, you know, $10 million is great. I think Amazon maybe could donate a bit more, considering how much effect it's had on the waste stream. But so that's urging companies to take responsibility in these ways is very important for changing the online shopping waste stream, certainly.
Another question here from Rich in Yreka, California. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Beth Porter, the author of Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine.
Thank you for taking my call, and I'm from Yreka. I'd like to point out that the widespread adaptation of single-stream recycling has resulted in a lot of the issues with recycling. Specifically, it has dramatically increased the contamination rates. I know that we used to have dual-stream recycling in Humboldt County. Contamination rate was under 5%. Now it's in excess of 30%. This has destroyed the domestic markets for recycled products, and has led to the Chinese rejecting more of our products because of the contamination rate. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for mentioning single stream. The widespread use of single stream, I believe, started in California in the 90s and has just run through the country ever since then. So now most of our curbside programs in the U.S. are practicing single stream, where you put everything in one bin. And it did increase participation because, you know, you can just throw it in there and don't have to really know the ins and outs of how to sort it. But with that, we also saw this skyrocket of contamination. And also, you know, people just kind of thinking recycling as, oh, I'll just throw it in there and someone will deal with it. So I think there are a lot of benefits to dual and multi-stream sorting. Of course, the reduced contamination, churning out higher quality recycled material that's more appealing to manufacturers and in the marketplace. And I think also keeping people a little bit connected to our waste, to presenting that that need to think about what we're disposing and how we're disposing. Any way that we can interrupt these built-in habits that we've developed about just throwing something out and letting someone else deal with it, and helping people see that we all still have to deal with it collectively. You know, just because you throw something away doesn't mean it disappears. It goes somewhere, and it needs to ideally have a further life in the recycling stream. So we definitely cannot underscore the issue of contamination enough and how we need to address it. And in the book, I talk about ways that people can try to address it through single stream systems, because, I do think they're going to be certainly a part of our recycling system for the foreseeable future. But I have seen a few municipalities exploring moving back into dual stream simply because of the response from China and exactly what you said, the lower contamination rates that we see when we have sorting at the consumer level.
Yeah, China shutting the door really has an effect on the way people think about this now. And I just wonder, as a final question, whether this sort of ends up like discussions about global warming, that some people might feel, well, great, I'm virtuous, but the rest of the world isn't doing what I'm doing, so what does it matter? Does it?
Yeah, that's definitely a pervasive concern with recycling is, what about my individual impact and what will I do? And, I think that we've arrived at this issue of contamination through a lot of small choices that we make every day and every year that build up to be quite huge. So not only just doing your part, but getting it out there into your community, telling your friends and family about that, and spreading the knowledge about recycling. I've found that people really like to learn about recycling from other people. So if you can be that person in your community that folks ask, hey, is this recyclable? Hey, do you know about this? That's really helpful in helping other people learn it too. And so I think that we're going to continue to see more emphasis on recycling in the new year, particularly because of the China disruption. And fortunately, in the industry right now, there's a lot of turmoil, there's a lot of frustration, but there's also a lot of optimism that this is going to be a turning point for our recycling system, and that if we all engage, we'll be seeing greater environmental and economic benefits from recycling that maybe we haven't even seen before.
All right. The book is called Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine. Beth Porter, thank you.